When you came in today, you were given a little index card, so keep that with you if you would. At the end of the service, I'm going to hopefully ask you to, I will ask you, and hopefully you will fill those out, and we'll do something with them. In chapel today, I want to continue a series that I started at the beginning of this year, asking some questions or dealing with some issues that trouble me. I don't know that they trouble you, but they trouble me, and sometimes I feel that what troubles me might trouble other people. So that's my way of trying to figure out maybe that this could be relevant to you today as well. Back in September, we talked about, do I really need God? And we concluded that if we're on mission for God, if we're doing what he's asking us to do in the world, then we need him. If we're not on mission for God, I would conclude that you can pretty much live your life however you want to. Then in December, I talked about the issue of, aren't Christians just super intolerant, and aren't we just totally bigoted, and don't we just hate a lot of people, or isn't that our rap, and how do we deal with that? We tried to deal with that a little bit there in December. Today I want to address, for me, the most troubling question that I've ever had, and I'm sure I ever will have. In fact, if you add it up on one side of a weight, all the questions that I have about anything in life, and put all of them on this side, and put this question on this side would weigh down much more than all of these others on this side. And that's the question I've probably only addressed one other time in my life in a public way, and so I'm a little bit uneasy about doing it in front of all you people today. But that question has to do with God and evil. So if you're here today trying to get blessed and trying to figure out how to go out high and try to just, you know, kind of like airy through this time, I'm going to really try to challenge your mind to think through this question with me today. Classically put, the question is this. If God is all-loving, he would eliminate all suffering. And if he were all-powerful, he could eliminate all suffering. But there's obviously a lot of evil and suffering in this world to a horrifying extent. Every day we see it. So therefore, either God is not all-powerful or he is not all-loving. In either case, he's not the God of the Bible. And therefore, the God of the Bible does not exist. Now, evil comes in three varieties, as far as I can tell. Or at least it looks like it does. It comes in natural evil, like all the things that can happen and go wrong in nature. And frankly, at least the consequences of natural evil are going down as the world becomes more modern. We're able to reduce the loss of life because of natural evil, but still, indiscriminate disasters kill a lot of people every year. The second kind of evil is human evil, what we do to each other. And there's a lot of human evil in the world, right? Some of you have been victims of other people's abuse or have been affected by someone else's addiction or your own actions have affected other people's lives and caused great suffering to them. The third kind of evil that I want to address with you today. And it's the most perplexing for me, and that is evil or suffering perpetrated by God. I hate to call this a third kind of evil because I'm not really sure about it, but I want to make a problem for you today before I answer it. I probably can't pose this issue any more starkly than this. Couldn't a good, powerful, all-wise, merciful, even just God have figured out a way to save his people Israel other than by killing hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands?
Okay, I got to get my question for you. Couldn't an all-powerful, all-wise, all-loving, all-merciful, even all-just God have figured out a way to deliver his people, Israel, from Egypt without killing hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of the firstborn in Egypt? Why perpetrate a mass murder to deliver your favorite humans? And when I hear that story, most of the time I baptize it with our Christian and Judeo-Christian kind of thing. But at its rawest, it's like, what kind of a God are we dealing with here? So this morning, what I'm going to do in front of you is something I've really never done before. I want to model in front of you my process of wrestling with this problem. And due to some times, 25 minutes, it's hard to thoroughly wrestle with this problem. But I'm going to try to do that with you as much as I can today. I'm going to try to walk you into a situation in the year 605 B.C. I'm going to try to get it away from the Exodus. It will go right to the year 605 B.C. And it's the nation of Judah. We're going to go to the city of Jerusalem. And specifically, there were a couple of prophets that were working then, at least true prophets. One was named Habakkuk, and the other one was named Jeremiah. Both of them were contemporaries with one another. And they had to grapple with the evil of their time. Thanks. You guys are working the slides for me. Good. It was a very dark time in history for those two prophets and for the people of God. It was a period of rampant greed and envy and exploitation of the poor. There was murder and wealth disparity and political corruption and addiction and abuse of power and idolatry, all compounded by a confusing and unfaithful religious practice led by a slew of false prophets. And this was just the people of Israel. This was just the people of Judah, God's supposed people. And in the face of such rampant evil in his own society, Habakkuk voices a serious complaint against God. We'll move it forward here. Listen to what he says here. Whatever your view of scriptures are here, this complaint on Habakkuk toward God is good enough to make it into the Bible. Oh Lord, how long must I call for help before you will listen? I shout to you in vain. There is no answer. Help! Murder! I cry. But no one comes to save. Must I forever see this sin and sadness all around me? Wherever I look, I see oppression and bribery and men who love to argue and to fight. The law is not enforced, and there is no justice given in the courts. For the wicked far outnumber the righteous, and bribes and trickery prevail. God, what are you doing? Where are you? Don't you see us? Don't you care? Why don't you show up? Why don't you do something? Why don't you at least give me a prophet an answer? I don't know if you've ever felt like that, maybe not to the extent that Habakkuk has voiced it here, but imagine getting the answer that he gets. Let's look at the answer here. So God gives him an answer and removes the terrible silence. Look around at the godless nations, he says. Look long and hard. Brace yourself for a shock. These are God's words. Something's about to take place, and you're going to find it hard to believe. I'm about to raise up Babylonians to punish you. Babylonians, fierce and ferocious. World-conquering Babylon, grabbing up nations right and left. A dreadful and terrible people, making up its own rules as it goes. Their horses run like the wind, attack like bloodthirsty wolves. A stampede of galloping horses thunders out of nowhere. They descend like vultures circling in on carrion. They're out to kill. Death is on their minds. They collect victims like squirrels gathering nuts. They mock kings. They poke fun at generals, spit on forts, and leave them in the dust. They'll all be blown away by the wind. Brazen in sin, they call strength their god. These were some bad dudes. These were some really bad dudes. God's people had consistently flaunted his law and his plan for them. And so God tells Habakkuk that he's going to exile them into Babylon, a city that's about 60 miles southwest of current-day Baghdad. And he's going to punish them there for their sin. But here's the thing. God goes out of his way taking credit for sicking the Babylonians on his own people. I'm about to raise up the Babylonians to punish you. It's as though God delights to take credit for the suffering that's going to come because he's raising up these people. He knows the devastation that will wreak on his people over three successive invasions over the next 18 years that he tells Habakkuk this. He knows that people will be tortured and raped and enslaved and forced to make some terrible choices. And he takes credit for bringing this evil on his people. Within a year or two of this time, Jehoiakim the king, his wife the queen, many of the religious and economic and civic leaders of Judah will be hauled away to Nineveh, including Daniel, who we know of. And they'll be captured and taken away to live several hundred miles from their homes. Interesting, Saddam Hussein, who died by hanging on December 30th, 2006, so it's about 13 years ago, he saw himself as a modern-day Nebuchadnezzar, who was going to resurrect kind of the Babylonian era from that time. But in reality, he didn't even approximate the kind of cruelty and brutality of his idol. So can you imagine what Habakkuk must have been thinking when he got this message from God that the Babylonians were going to overtake his people in Judah? Well, you don't have to. He pipes up. And he just about loses it at the end of chapter 1 of Habakkuk. He says, God, you're from eternity, aren't you? Holy God, we aren't going to die, are we? God, you chose Babylonians for your judgment work? Rock solid God, you gave them the job of discipline? But you can't be serious. You can't condone evil. So why don't you do something about this? Why are you silent now? This outrage, evil men swallow up the righteous, and you stand around and watch. You're treating men and women as so many fish in the ocean, swimming without direction, swimming but not getting anywhere. Then this evil Babylonian arrives and goes fishing, and he pulls in a good catch. He catches his limit and fills his creel a good day of fishing. He's happy. He praises his rod and reel, piles his fishing gear up on an altar and worships it. It's made his day, and he's going to eat well tonight. Are you going to let this go on and on? Will you let the Babylonian fishermen fish like a weekend angler, killing people as if they're nothing but fish? About the same time, his contemporary prophet Jeremiah quotes the Lord over in Jeremiah 29, verses 17 to 19, and says, this is what the Lord of heaven's armies says. I will send war, famine, and disease upon them. Now, this is his people. And make them like bad figs, too rotten to eat. Yes, I will pursue them with war, famine, and disease. And I will scatter them around the world. In every nation where I send them, I will make them an object of damnation, horror, contempt, and mockery. I don't like reading these kind of words. I certainly hope he doesn't do that to Crown College. Why? Because they refuse to listen to me. I ask the question, don't you think that seems like a little bit of an overreaction on God's part? He's going to scatter them to the winds as an object of damnation because they just refuse to listen to him? What are we to make of this? And this could be replicated 50 times in the Old Testament and a few times in the New Testament. How are you processing this? If our God is capable of this kind of malevolence toward his own people, what greater depths of suffering could he exact on his not people? I've been wrestling with this problem inside for 45 years since I sat where you're sitting. It doesn't come up every day. It doesn't strike me deeply all the time, but I think it is one of the most decaying of our faith kinds of issues if we don't somehow grapple with it. And so for the balance of my time this morning, I want to offer you some hope in how to understand such a God, and how to love such a being, and how to process such powerful words that if you ever read the scriptures from beginning to end, you come across frequently. I want to model some tools to manage my doubts. And I say manage my doubts because I haven't eliminated them all. And not give up on God when I have been tempted to do so. Now let me make one other final preamble before I get into that. And that is this. Some skeptics have charged that the Christian religion was invented in order to provide comfort in a cruel world, some meaning in the face of otherwise, you know, a senseless kind of existence. I have never, ever understood that charge against Christianity. Maybe they have never really taken seriously Habakkuk's complaint. Do you think that he kind of has some kind of a crutch, some kind of, you know, fairy tale faith that he's leaning on here? Let me say this. I think it's much harder to believe in a God who talks like this in Habakkuk than it would be for me not to believe. To not believe would relieve me of having to wrestle with God. It would relieve me of being obligated to God or fitting square-sized facts into round-sized faith holes. Faith is anything but a crutch for us. For me, it's more like a Mensa puzzle or a riddle that only the author knows. Or it's a locked room with no exit and no key. Faith doesn't give me solace all the time. Sometimes it confuses me. So what do I do? Because I'm not going to give it up. We sang about the God of wonders. And I love the God of wonders. So let me try to work through this with you briefly and quickly this morning. Number one, I try to be brutally honest before God with my intellectual struggles. I don't mince words. I don't sugarcoat my feelings with him. I own up to my skepticism. With Habakkuk, I say, God, you got to be kidding. You're going to do what? How did you let that happen? What am I missing? How come I can't fit that puzzle piece into the big picture? Are you some kind of terrorist? Are you going out of your way to take credit for things that none of us would ever want to take credit for? I think I'm on safe ground here a little bit. I don't think I'm going to get bolted by lightning. I see Habakkuk asking the same questions. What benefit is there for me to hide from God anyway? You know, he knows what's going on down here and up here. So I just brutally talk to him. Second thing is, I sometimes verbalize, I'm kind of doing it with you today, my doubts to others, right? Not in the same way as I do to God. I can sometimes even be worse than this with God. But I do sometimes sanitize my thoughts with others. But I find it rather easy to surmise that Jeremiah and Habakkuk were two contemporary true prophets in Judah. And there was a real group of false prophets in the same city. Hananiah and Zedekiah and Shemaiah and Kaliah, we know some of their names. And I think that Habakkuk and Jeremiah got together to talk about how they viewed God and how they were processing what God was telling both of them. I so wonder what their conversations must have been like. You know, Crown is a place you can have those conversations. You can enter into them. You can actually pose some questions. You can actually deal with your faith. You can actually converse with friends and faculty. And I want to tell you that you're not going to get that chance as often when you leave here. You can't talk like this in a church. I would never deliver this message in a church. I wouldn't trust the people with it. I don't know if I can trust you with it. Just don't talk like this very often. But this is at the core of our faith sometimes, is to deal with these issues that we have to come to grips with. And so I challenge you to use one another sometimes to verbalize some of your doubts that you have. Third, I don't make my doubts the final story. You know, I am more than my doubts. They don't have to be my final story. They're part of my story, but so also are the promises of God. Habakkuk 2:4, just in the next chapter, Habakkuk says, wicked people are puffed up. Their desires don't line up right. But the righteous person shall live by faith. This was a verse that propelled the Reformation. And it was a promise here out of the darkness of Habakkuk's day. Later on in chapter 2, verse 14, Habakkuk gets the testimony from God that the time will come when all the earth is filled as the waters fill the sea with an awareness of the glory of the Lord. And later in Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 20, he says, but oh, God is in his holy temple. Shh. Everyone, quiet. Listen. Habakkuk, he was more than his doubts. And I am more than my doubts. I also remind myself that there is no system of thought that can satisfactorily answer all of life's difficult questions. Atheism doesn't, agnosticism doesn't, Buddhism doesn't, skepticism doesn't, secularism doesn't. No other major religion does either. So the fact that I have doubts, I mean, join the human race. I can't answer every single question that I have, and I can't answer every single question that you're going to have. And so when I turn to the scriptures, I find three scriptures that for me are absolutely essential to quell my doubts. Let me offer them to you and see if they will help you as well. The first one is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 9 and 12, where Paul says, we know in part and we prophesy in part. For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. There's so much to unpack here. Let me try a little bit. Even one who spoke for God in the Bible, maybe more than anyone but Moses, the Apostle Paul. Paul himself says that we know only in part and we prophesy only in part. The best that I can hope for in this world is only a partial knowledge or understanding of anything. I'm not going to get it all. If it's a 1,000-piece puzzle, some of the pieces are just going to be missing. Even Paul said that we see only a reflection. We don't see something that is actual. We see reflection. It's not 100% accurate. Even Paul hoped for the day that we shall be fully known. And that we shall fully know. What do I expect? That I'm going to somehow exceed what Paul was able to figure out? He says we are fully known. God knows my heart. He knows my struggles. He accepts my desire to fit everything together neatly, but that I can't. He knows that I brood over hard questions that lead me down dark paths sometimes. He knows that I sometimes question his goodness and think somehow that he isn't somebody I want to love or worship. He knows that I love to read history and biography and science, and when I do, I find all kinds of issues raised that I just wonder about his providence or his consistency or his perfection or the way he works his plan out. God knows me fully. And in the same chapter, he asks me to exhibit faith and hope and love. When I think about those, I think about faith being something to hang on to him, to trust in him, to take the long view, to seek the big picture, not to slip away or to slide away or to just filter away from him. And like the person in Mark 9 who said, God, Jesus, I believe, help my unbelief. I want to say that to God too. Help me. He asked me to hope in him. Someday, he promises that I will fully know, that I have so much to look forward to, and I can't wait for that day. I have to admit, I want to know now, but I have to just hope that someday I will know. And he asked me to love. He asked me to love him and to love others. And can I park my questions long enough to see his stunning glories and to remind me of, to live in humble adoration of him? And respect
and positive regard for others. Faith, hope, and love are not easy for me. But what's the alternative? To substitute disappointment, futility, indifference? I am not going to choose that. And I won't live like that, at least most days. John, over in 1 John 3:2, says this: "Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we will see him like he is." What we will be has not yet been made known. There's a day yet to come when I will be more than I am today. Well, I will know more than I know today. Well, I'll be able to process more than I can process today. And there's much more in store for me to become and to enter into. And I want that, and I long for that, and I need that. And I don't want to throw that away, and I hang on to that despite my doubts. Someday, when Christ appears, we will see him as he is. I don't see him as he is today. And I choose not to live in my doubts all the time. And not even John saw him as he is. So I have questions, and I see discrepancies, and I don't have full understanding, and I have spiritual cataracts. It's partial what I get today, but we're going to get it all someday, and we're going to know it. John, over in John 6, or actually the discussion between Peter and Jesus in John chapter 6, is the third passage that gives me great hope. Jesus says the narrative says, from this time many of the disciples turned their back and no longer followed him. And Jesus says, "You don't want to leave me too, do you?" Jesus asked the 12, and Simon Peter answered him and said, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life." Sometimes I'm tempted to wander, to leave. "Do you want to leave me too?" Jesus asks. And I feel as though my doubts will overcome me sometimes. And then I remember what Peter says, "Lord, who are we going to go to? Am I going to go to Lucretius, who was a contemporary of the Apostle Paul, who wrote a book on the nature of things and popularized Epicurean philosophy, which says that everything is just atomic and that there is nothing that is spiritual, and the best we can do is just to eat, live, and eat, drink, and be merry, and pursue as much pleasure as we can in this world? Am I going to go to Nietzsche, and whose God is dead, and focus on the will to power and his Übermensch and the reevaluation of all values and the transformation, trans-revolution of values? Didn't work out too well for Nietzsche, did it? Am I going to go to Richard Dawkins? Richard Dawkins, who says that any creative intelligence of sufficient complexity to design anything comes into existence only as the end product of an extended process of gradual evolution. In other words, there's no intelligence at the beginning of anything. There's only intelligence at the end of evolution. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. Am I going to go to John Lennon? Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It's not hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. No religion to. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. You know, I think the gospel's better than that. So I have to choose. I can't straddle the fence all the time. And so Jesus says you can't serve two masters. There's good evidence for Christianity and its major tenets. And I choose to believe. Now, when you came in today, you were given a card like this. And a pen, maybe. Or maybe you already have a pen or a pencil. And what I want you to do with these cards, am I on? Not on here, okay. What I want you to do with these cards is I want you to write down what your biggest doubt is. I've given you mine today. I've tried to process it with you. I've tried to be about as open as I can with you about it.
What's your biggest doubt? What causes you the most consternation in your faith? 10 years from now, what is the thing that could lead you away from Christ if you don't manage that doubt? And I want you to write that down on your card. Take a moment to just write it down on the card, if you would. When we first moved into our house, it was in June of 2013, and there were all kinds of weeds in the backyard, and I remember my wife and my son doing the weeding, but I remember one day as they were out in the backyard, we have a beautiful backyard. Some of you have been there and seen, you know, the beautiful landscaping. But when we got there, it wasn't so beautiful, and there were these weeds that were just growing out of control. And I remember my son saying at one point, when he pulled this weed out and he got back there, he says, "There's a tree back here." I mean, the weeds were so big that it had covered up this evergreen tree. And almost every year, we do weeding in our backyard. And our doubts are like weeds. We pull them out, but they're going to regrow. I don't think you can eliminate weeds. I don't think you can eliminate your doubts. But you know what you can do? You can pull them up. And you can put the weeds in the wheelbarrow, and you can go get rid of them for a while. And then they'll come back again, and then you pull them up, and you throw them in the wheelbarrow, and you take them away again. And they'll come back, and then you pull them up, and you don't let the weed become the landscape of your life. If it does, you will not stay Christian. And I'm asking you today, write down your biggest doubt today. It may not be the biggest one that'll ever be your doubt or your biggest doubt, but write it down today. And as the band comes and sings this last song, would you come and just throw your doubt in the wheelbarrow? Just dump it in. And then you go back and sit down and we'll continue to sing the song. And I'd love to have a wheelbarrow full of doubts here that we just go dump. And we weed a little bit of our life today. At least we recognize that we have this doubt and we got to deal with it. So let's stand together as we sing this last song. And if you want to, just come and throw your doubt into the wheelbarrow this morning.